Thank you, and you're all very welcome. On behalf of the School of Chemical and Bioprocess Engineering, and on behalf of the Irish and British Associations for Crystal Growth, I'd like to welcome you to the first of two public lectures being held today as part of our annual conference. And I would like to call on Dr. Hugh Brady, President of University College Dublin, to introduce the speaker today.
Well, guests, colleagues, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to sunny UCD. I should emphasize that. It's always like this on the UCD campus. We guarantee it for all of our major symposia. Welcome to UCD, to the inaugural meeting of the Irish Association for Crystal Growth, and a special welcome to our visitors from the British Association for Crystal Growth. We're honored to host such an eminent group of academic and industrial experts discussing a topic of such importance, impacting as it does on a wide range of disciplines, from genetics to pharmaceutical sciences to electronic engineering. It's wonderful to be able to recognize the achievements of one of the most important Irish-born scientists of the 20th century, J.D. Bernal, who hails from Tipperary, and we'll come back to that for any Tipperary lovers in the audience, because this is a theme. But who established crystallography as a fundamental tool in the study of the basic structures of biological molecules. It's a particular honor to welcome the scientist who brought this study to perhaps its pinnacle of achievement, Nobel laureate Dr. James Watson. You're very welcome, sir. There are, in all fields of science, pivotal moments when the nature of the discipline changes because of new understanding or new developments, which alter fundamentally how scientists go about their work, and which represent step changes for mankind. The invention of the jet engine, the transistor in engineering, the understanding of blood flow and development of antibiotics in medicine, the discovery of the structure of matter and the nature of light in physics and chemistry, have all had enormous impact on the way that we live. The work of Jim Watson is undoubtedly in this league. The elucidation of the structure of DNA is rightly acknowledged as one of mankind's greatest achievements. The implications of this discovery is still being felt throughout the biological sciences, constantly leading to new and more sophisticated insights into the nature of life. Here at UCD, as in every other major academic institution, so much of our research in biomolecular and biomedical science stems from this fundamental discovery. However, notwithstanding the significance of Dr. Watson's work in biological science, his discovery, I think you'd agree, has a greater importance. And as with the work of Newton, Einstein, Curie, and many other great scientists, the discovery of the structure of DNA has captured the public imagination. Even those who profess ignorance of science have heard of and recognize the importance of Jim Watson's work. It's a story that continues to inspire in new generations of young people a belief in the possibilities of scientific discovery. His book, The Double Helix, describes a monumental event in such real detail as to make it possible to believe that any researcher working in any laboratory is capable of inspiration and greatness. And the fact that most of us don't often reach such dizzy heights doesn't diminish the enjoyment and the satisfaction to be found through scientific investigation. Now, I, as a university president, fully realize it's traditional now that I would take you through a journey of the speaker's career highlights, and I could give you every minute detail on Dr. Watson's career, his time at Chicago, Indiana, Cavendish, Caltech, Harvard, Cold Spring Harbor, etc. But my real challenge was to find something that you may not know about the man, and it's this. He's actually Irish. And in terms of his lineage, I have no doubt that his real genius is probably inherited from County Tipperary, and I'm going to take you through a little bit as to why that is. I hope I have this right, but his mother, Margaret Jean Mitchell, was the only child of Lachlan Alexander Mitchell, a Scottish-born tailor, and Elizabeth Gleeson, the daughter of an Irish immigrant couple who had emigrated from Tipperary to the US during the Great Irish potato famine in the 1840s. And early in her adolescence, Elizabeth, or Lizzie as she was known, left the family farm in the Midwest on a journey that ultimately led to Chicago, where she married Lachlan Alexander Mitchell, and their daughter, in turn, gave birth to Jim, and the rest is history. So another great Tipperary success story. So it's therefore, it's a great pleasure for me to introduce a great Irishman, Dr. James Watson, to deliver his lecture entitled Rules for Doing High-Level Science. Dr. Watson, you're very welcome.
It's a great pleasure being back in Dublin. When I accepted the invitation, I thought my latest and probably last book would just be in the bookstands, but Oxford University Press delayed it by 6 weeks. And it's a recounting of my life from birth to when many people would say their life ends when I left Harvard. But in many ways, I think that's when my life started. But it's a sort of tour through academia, and its opening sentence is, I was born in 1928 in Chicago into a family which believed in books, birds, and the Democratic Party. I refer to my mother as an Irish Democrat. Most Irish in Chicago in those days were Democrats. Poverty and the Democratic Party went together for a long time. Before the, you know, today, when the Democratic Party is a party of many fat cats. And I think I had a really very superior upbringing. Not in poverty, we were pretty close to it. We lived in a two-bedroom bungalow where there was one bedroom went to my parents, one bedroom went to my Irish grandmother, and my sister and I lived in the attic in bunk beds. And but I never remember, the Depression came and my father sold his car. So we were about an hour from streetcar by the loop. So I seldom saw the center of Chicago. But we were only about 25 minutes by streetcar from the University of Chicago. And it was at the University of Chicago, which had a program then of admitting students at 15. It was during the war. So I was very lucky. I missed the last 2 years of American high school, and started to get a university education at 15, and it was very broad. It was based on the great books. And Chicago had the great wisdom of then not looking with envy to or admiration to New York or Boston, but look to Europe. So it was very much an education in Western civilization, where most of the great ideas had come from Europe, and initially from Greece and Rome. And it was, I guess if anything I got out of Chicago is your life should be here, the University of Chicago reason, based on reason. My father particularly liked Jewish intellectuals because they, you know, more than any other people, they didn't believe in God. And I was told avoid revelation. And so I went, because of my mother being Irish, I went to, I didn't go to I went to a Lady of Peace church and was had First Communion and Confirmation until the age of 11. And then they second family value, birds took over, and Sundays were spent, Sunday mornings, on bird walks with my father. Also on Friday afternoons, or Friday evenings, we would walk to the public library about a mile away. So my life was going to the public library, going out and looking for birds. The second sort of, besides books and birds, I got from my family was honesty. You know, be honest. In your voice as well as other things. So that, I think, from early on got me into trouble. You know, not agreeing with values in neighborhood kids or so on. So I learned to keep my mouth shut. But I think honesty was... And another real value was social justice. Fairness, fair play. With the realization that many people were not treated to fair play. And so during the Great Depression, you know, novels like John Steinbeck's The Grapes of Wrath, you know, these were people who didn't get social justice. And the last value was responsibility. That is, those people who had the means to help society survive, as you had to be interested in your society. And, you know, if you were so gifted, you would, or lucky, you would help lead society. So very much, so my mother took me to a Democratic convention in 1940. She was a precinct captain. The elections were held in our house. And we just, you know, wanted Democrats to be elected in Chicago and Roosevelt to be elected, you know, as president. So our whole sort of formative upbringing was with Franklin Roosevelt. So he was sort of the big hero of my life. And later Churchill, because of fighting the Germans. It was a battle that had to happen. So my boyhood was probably serious. I'm glad it was. My father knew enough to be, I think, depressed at times when the Germans were winning battles. But, and I worried too. So I think I've always been both a worrier and an optimist. You really have to know how things will go wrong and take steps to prevent them from going wrong. Something which our current government in Washington totally has no regard for. You know, I call our current government rich trash. Trash. Yes, they don't care the consequence of their actions. So, as you can see, I brought up a strong political feelings. My book, which looks back, it has, at the end of each chapter, sort of rules for success as a child, and the first rule was avoid fighting bigger boys or dogs. Second was put spin on balls, something I still try to do when I play tennis. And the third rule got serious in a different way, never accept a dare that puts your life at risk. It's not fair to your mother. So, another rule was, you know, only accept truth which comes from observation and experience. So, and then last rule for being a child is have young heroes. So I guess my big hero now is Roger Federer. So you should, you know, always try and be like your heroes. By the time I was 18, my hero was, I think, becoming Linus Pauling. You know, he was a chemist who was going to try and understand life in terms of chemistry. Today I thought I would tell you the rules for doing important science, which was, you know, why did Crick and I find the double helix? I have rules for being a graduate student, and probably the most important of them is seek out a young thesis advisor. Don't go toward fame, go for a new field. And I did that. I went to Indiana because the great geneticist Herman Muller had just gone there and had just got the Nobel Prize. And he was wonderful to listen to lectures, but he was working on Drosophila, which, you know, it didn't take much brains to know the field. Then it had gone into a seemingly terminal decline. It's, of course, come out of it. But then there was no value learning Drosophila genetics. And I opted to work on bacterial viruses, and I became the first PhD student of my thesis advisor, the 34-year-old Salvador Luria. So I got an enormous amount of attention. And it was before he had any children. So, he worked all the time. And so he would be in the lab on Saturdays. So another rule, the later one, very important, is have the courage to sit in the front row. Because if you're in the front row, you're apt to ask questions. So if you don't understand anything, just interrupt the speaker. It's a sort of good rule is that most speakers don't know how to speak. And so you don't understand what they're saying, and someone has to say, I don't understand. So you reach your, you know, first point in your career when you admit you don't understand what the lecturer is saying. The only advantage of sitting in the back row is you can read a newspaper in case the lecturer gets dull. Or walk out when no one sees you. But if you're really interested in a subject, sit in the front row. Okay. And another thing you should sort of learn is that leave a field before it bores you. So what you're doing for your thesis research hopefully doesn't bore you, but it doesn't mean you should do the same for the rest of your life. You know, always work on what interests you the most, because you will work harder. So don't stick with something just because, you know, other people are interested in it. Just try and move toward really what, you know, seems to be the most important. Now, going toward the important means you're sort of going to a frontier. The first rule, you know, which I didn't think this way when I went to England and or went to Europe in pursuit of DNA, was work on something before other people are working on it. So go into a field where a small field, not a big field. I don't think there were 50 people seriously interested, less than that, in DNA at the time I went to Europe. And I went to Copenhagen thinking that the Danish biochemist, Herman Kalkar, is going to try and work on DNA. But then I discovered he was working on nucleosides and wanted me to work on enzymes that made nucleosides. I was just bored. So I didn't do it. And basically passed a year until I saw Wilkins, Morris Wilkins, at a tiny meeting in Italy, in Naples. And he displayed a picture of DNA, which was much more regular than the pictures I'd seen when I was a graduate student, sort of crystalline DNA. And so I saw that and realized that the person who understood that picture would, you know, finally know what DNA was. And hopefully if you knew the structure, you might go from structure to function. So, you know, work on a field before other people are interested in it. So Wilkins didn't want me in his lab, probably sensing I didn't know anything. And I ended up in Cambridge and with John Kedrow, who was working on myoglobin. And as soon as I met Kedrow, he said, you're going to enjoy Crick. So I met Francis, and within a day, you know, we were talking about solving the structure of the double of DNA, because Linus Pauling had just come up with the alpha helix for polypeptide chains. So, so I went into DNA when, and I should say, it wasn't just dumb people who were not interested in DNA. Perutz and Kendrew showed no interest in DNA until we found the answer. Yeah. So it wasn't as if people encouraged me to be interested in DNA. They were, you know, following J.D. Burnell, the big problem was the three-dimensional structure of proteins. So, you know, it was a good problem. They saw no reason to leave an important problem. And you know, didn't know how to do proteins, so they certainly weren't going to still further overextend themselves by moving on to DNA. Now, the second rule is, though, even though something is very important and no one else is working on it, don't work on it unless you think you can get the answer in 3 years. That's about all anyone will give you a postdoctoral fellowship, you know. And so, you know, going into something that, so you have to have a path to the top of the mountain, or, you know, you see a mountain and you think, I might get there if I go this way, turn this way. So you have to have a potential path. So that's the second rule. And the path we thought was just build molecular models. Try and think like you're a polynucleotide chain. How would you want to fold up? That was the sort of, now, the difficulty was that neither Crick or I knew any chemistry. You know, I'd taken at least some courses, but, you know, low level. You know, when I had a choice of taking a serious organic chemistry course or one designed for nurses, well, you know, nurses and biologists, that's the one I took. So my education in chemistry was very incomplete. But, you know, the big problem was a problem in chemistry. So, you know, so that was, you know, have a route to the top. So, you know, if you're going for gold, you know, have some reason for thinking you're near it. The third rule is, you know, when you're at a frontier, you know, if you're, you know, in New Guinea or someplace, don't be alone. Have a teammate. So, yeah, it's just too dangerous to be out there when no one knows really what you're going to do next alone. It's easy to lose courage. But if there are two of you, but it's important that your teammate be intelligent. Yeah. So don't be with someone, you know, preferably be with someone who knows more than you. So I brought the passion for DNA, and Francis brought the ability to interpret X-ray photographs. So we were a good team. He would have never gone into it. He admits he would have never thought about DNA if I hadn't shown up. And when I showed up without knowing about Quick, I thought, I'm going to have to spend 3 years learning crystallography. And the moment I saw Francis, I realized I never had to learn any. He knew it. So it would be a waste of my time. You know, I would never know it well enough to do what he did. So I relied on him. The fourth rule was, and this, you know, even if you have a bright, never be the brightest person in the room. Because you can't. So Quick and I actually only made the big discovery because there was a real chemist in the room. We were trying to, you know, we were not bright chemists. Now, most chemists didn't help us, but there was, for 1 year, Jerry Donahue, a quantum chemist from Caltech. And without Jerry, we had not got the answer. Because I was trying to make base pairs using the enol forms of guanine and thymine when they were keto. So Jerry saw the base pairs I was trying to make, you know, guanine with guanine, and he said, you got the hydrogen atoms in the wrong location. So the rule is just always be in the most intelligent, you know, go to the place where the brightest, bright people. You know, I wanted to go to Cambridge because, you know, it was very famous. And, you know, afterwards I realized that Cambridge was the best university in the world then. You know, it was better than Caltech. At least, you know, for biology. It was, you know, it was filled with really very bright people. And so, you know, bright people tend to want to be with other bright people. So we wouldn't have made the discovery if we were by ourselves. Okay. The fifth rule was talk to your competitors. Something which is very easy to not do. Because either you're afraid you're going to tell them something they, you know, you'll tell them your secrets and they'll use it. Or just because, you know, they're competing with you, you don't want, they're bad people. And so it was essential that. Even though Wilkins didn't want me in his lab, then I somehow talked to him. Now, as soon as I got to Cambridge, I learned that Francis and Morris were friends. They had met after the war. Francis was thinking about going into biology, and Wilkins, I had changed from being a naturalist to wanting to do genetics by reading Schrodinger's little book, What Is Life? From the three lectures given here in Dublin in 1943. So without Schrodinger's lectures, you know, everything would be set back. Wilkins was told by Harry Massey, Australian physicist, to read What Is Life. Massey had gone to Berkeley to lead the British uranium effort. And Wilkins was in Berkeley when Massey told him. Massey was Francis's effectively boss at the Admiralty during the war. And knew, really spotted Francis's really deep penetrating intellect. And realized after the war, Francis didn't know what to do and told him. Massey told Francis to read What Is Life. So Massey had a big influence. And so they met, and Wilkins tried to get Francis a job with Randall. the biophysics in King's College London. And to my good fortune, Randall said no, he didn't want Crick. I think, you know, 5 minutes with Francis would realize they had a very loud voice and a rather irreverent laugh. So, you know, Randall was in many ways a pathetic little man. Yes, just awful. And so Francis could not have tolerated Randall. Wilkins, you know, did. And, you know, Wilkins, when I met him, was, you know, the victim of Randall. Randall had offered Rosalind Franklin a job, thinking she was a crystallographer and could interpret the X-ray pictures that Wilkins had taken. So when I arrived in Cambridge, Wilkins had been essentially shut out of DNA, even though it was his problem. Rosalind Franklin thought it was her problem. She must have been autistic. I think she probably was. You know, to think that she could take away someone else's problem and a research student and him not. Yeah. She had absolutely no sense of fair play whatsoever. So it was, you know, and you could say, well, why didn't she know fair play? Well, I think she had Asperger's syndrome. I just don't think she could interpret other people's emotions. And so it was a strange thing. So, you know, I afterwards got to know Rosalind. Rosalind, as she got over the barrier, you know, I wouldn't say she's delightful, but, you know, she was perfectly all right. She wasn't mean or nasty, so why did she think she owned DNA? Yeah. That's why the story is so interesting. Anyway, she didn't want to speak because she, I think Wilkins even had spotted the space group, and Rosalind was monoclinic. And it should have told anyone that there were two chains running in opposite direction. Rosalind didn't really like to think about space groups, I think, and went to Oxford for a crucial meeting to see Dorothy Hodgkin and ask about space groups, and said there were among the possibilities, she said, were two ones which involved mirror symmetry. Which, you know, once you know, there was no mirror symmetry in Rosalind. And so Dorothy immediately sensed that Rosalind didn't know anything about space groups or biology, and told her to go into the next room and talk to the Scottish-educated Jack Donitz. And Rosalind, you know, after about a half hour left, and never went back to Oxford. So she never had anyone tell her the significance of the space group. So it was, I think, her inability to deal with someone saying she didn't know anything. So I was lucky, I was Irish partly, and I'd never expected to know anything. You know, it was a culture which, you know, I just felt, you know, I was never going to be a big thinker, so I needed, you know, help from other people. Whereas Rosalind actually, you know, had been educated, so, you know, you should be self-reliant. I thought that's just a way to slow you down. And so another virtue of being a sort of not, you know, too well-bred American was Francis couldn't go up to Cambridge, go down to London to see Wilkins without writing him a letter saying, I'm going to be in London, are you free to see me? You know, I'd just go to the door and, you know, I wouldn't. You know, I'd just go. But Francis couldn't go without writing a letter. So when I got the, and then, you know, I didn't know Linus Pauling, but Linus had sent his son Peter to Cambridge. a great luck, because one, we knew that Linus was suddenly working on DNA in the fall, late fall of 1952. And then Linus had his manuscript and sent a copy to Sir Lawrence Bragg, who being, you know, not wanting to have Crick around longer than necessary, would have never shown us the manuscript, because it might divert Crick from finishing his PhD thesis on proteins. And but Peter, he sent Peter a copy, and Peter gave it to me with, and you know, I grabbed it from Peter, and you know, saw the three chains and that it was holding it together by hydrogen bonds between phosphate groups. Whereas I've been told the hydrogens, you know, had just ionized off. And we're nowhere to be near the phosphate groups. So, you know, once I sensed that, I thought that, you know, it's wacko chemistry. Coming from supposedly the world's greatest chemist. So immediately I rushed over to Alex Todd's lab and said this, and Linus said, and Alex said, no. You know, you can't form a hydrogen bond between phosphates and DNA. So then we wondered, whether did Linus have some great idea that no one else had seen? Turned out he had no idea at all. And Linus, by that stage, the papers were published Pauling and Corey, so you might think he had an intelligent coworker. No. Pauling was just a technician. I mean, Corey was, you know. So Pauling to calculate the coordinates. So Linus really didn't see the need to get help from anyone. There was then also an incredible good piece of luck. I had met Linus at a small gathering, oh, it was 60 people or so, phage people in the Abbey in Royaumont, just before the Biochemical Congress. And Linus came out with Jeffries Wyman. And I told him of the Hershey-Chase experiment, and, you know, that he could sense that I wanted to find the structure of DNA. And I remember, you know, we're agreeing DNA should be solved. But, and Chargaff was there. And we had met Chargaff after the Congress. He came to Cambridge and saw John Kendrick. And Francis and I said we were going to solve the structure of DNA. And I think Francis revealed that we didn't know the formula of the bases, saying we could look them up. So there was no point in knowing really, you know, the formulas. Chargaff thought we were fools. In a sense, we were. It turned out if it hadn't been for Donahue, we would have been gone nowhere. But anyways, after in the return to the States, Pauling and Chargaff were on the same transatlantic boat. Pauling decided Chargaff was unpleasant and never talked. If he had talked to him, Chargaff had only one thing to say, the semi-equivalence of adenine and thymine and guanine and cytosine. Why Linus never read any Chargaff's papers before he wrote his paper is beyond me. Except maybe, you know, he had just found Chargaff so unpleasant he wouldn't read the papers. Linus also at this stage would send students to the library to look up things for him. I think maybe, you know, he wouldn't go over to the Kirchhoff biology building in this library. So he was, lived a very, the only person Linus really spoke to except giving enthusiastic lectures to students, was his wife, who knew no chemistry. So, there was the fact he was an old man. He was 50, but still. bizarre story. Anyways, you should talk to your competitors. And so I took the Pollock manuscript to London and didn't find Morris Wilkins, who had wanted to show the manuscript. And instead bumped into Roslyn, and I said, I have Pauling's manuscript, and you want to read it? And I said, he says, three-chained helix. I said, it's wrong. And she said, there's no point in my reading a DNA is not a helix. And so I then saw Morris, and Morris couldn't, you know, believe DNA was a helix. And so he went and opened the drawer and took out a bee photograph, which had been given to him by Roslyn because she had decided to give up work with DNA and get out of the unpleasant atmosphere of King's and move to Bernal's lab. So after she, you know, and she'd had a fake party or invitations to the death of the Helix party 6 months before. And then I told her that her reasons against the Helix Francis thought were illogical, and you could explain everything, the slight asymmetry by packing. She was very angry at me telling her she was wrong. So I remember just sort of fleeing from the room thinking she'd hit me. Yeah. And so Morris, you know, took out and I saw the bee photograph and it was a cross and, you know, it was a helix. There's no doubt about it. And Morris said 10 turns, you know, repeats in 34 angstroms. So I went back to Cambridge and told her to Bragg, who didn't want Crick to think about DNA, but even more didn't want Pauling to find the answer. Because Pauling had, you know, got the alpha helix and made Bragg feel very stupid because they didn't, you know, ask what conformation the peptide bond was planar. So it was my being an American, not having to write letters, just, you know, talking to competition. Now, and I had forgotten it, but it was very awkward once we found the double helix of how to tell Wilkins, because he was a friend. And John Kendrew said, better I do it, and just call Morris and say, Francis and Jim have a structure which you should come up and see. So he came up and looked at it and, you know, immediately concluded it was likely right. So Francis and I talked about it, and so we asked Morris to put his name on our paper. And he went back to London and wrote back, and he didn't want it. In his autobiography written just before he died, he said it was the biggest mistake of his life. And so I think we didn't even know, you know, we didn't think Roslyn, why would her name be on? She didn't believe it was the helix. And it was only about the time we found the base pairs that Roslyn was writing up her data in preparation of leaving King's. And looked at the B photograph, I think about it, and concluded it was a helix. So when she learned the details of our model, then she wrote up her paper. So, you know, we never asked her to have our name on her paper because we didn't think she played any role in it, but certainly if Wilkins hadn't shown me the picture, which was now for his to work, we wouldn't have had the structure. Anyways, it's pretty ambiguous, you know, afterwards. And so about 3 years later, I was in the Alps with in Verbier with Alfred Tissiers, and we were walking up, and this English group came down, and one was Wilkins' collaborator, Willie Seeds. And he looked at me and he said, how's Honest Jim today? So that was, you know, was I honest? And so that led to me when I wrote the story, from the very start, wanting to call the book Honest Jim. And because there was Lord Jim and there was Lucky Jim, and why not Honest Jim? And so the manuscript was sent to Francis under the title Honest Jim, which at first he didn't object to, but then he did, and he said, "You have no presumption to call yourself honest." And so I wrote back, "Only used car dealers use the term Honest Jim." So by calling it Honest Jim, you know, like Lord Jim, one was raising the whole question of, did we, you know, deserve it? Upon Francis not liking Honest Jim, I thought, well, we'll change the title Base Pairs. And Francis quickly saw that that had a double meaning and objected to that. So it became the Double Hiss. I would have, it was probably good for me, people, you know, didn't base their review on the title. People will, you know, argue it both ways, and I got 30 letters written from students someplace in the South asking me to apologize to them for my bad treatment of Rosalind Franklin. So, you know, it will probably always be there. But, when I was writing the book, I thought she's dead and she won't be hurt by what I say about her. So I might as well describe it. I wanted to write the story as a novel. I did not want to write it as a retrospective thing. So Truman Capote had written In Cold Blood. They called it a nonfiction novel. So I was going to write a nonfiction novel. And so I, and never saw it as a piece of history, but as something, you know, a good story to tell. I think you couldn't have written a convincing novel with the plot. It was just too implausible. Which is the difficulty of writing novels about science. Because you have to invent something and it doesn't have that smell of reality. I met Michael Creighton, who said, well, science is too boring to write novels about it, so you have to invent science villains, which he does, and makes scientists seem bad people. But I don't think we're, outside of being maybe slightly on the average more autistic than the average person, we're not evil people. So the last rule was never go to the frontier without someone to save you if you fail. So I had actually a fellowship that when I dealt with a German physicist who worked on bacterial viruses. When I lost my fellowship, he got me one, and it was for 2 years, one to be in Cambridge and one to be at Caltech after I had not found the structure of DNA. Because no one could believe that, you know, we were going to do it. So I had someone to save me, and Francis had essentially been told he had no future in the Cavendish after he got his PhD. But he could have got a job in Edinburgh. Murdoch Mitchison and Michael Swan knew her. So he would have, been. So it's pretty dangerous. So I had more security actually than Francis, because then Francis had a child. Francis was not paid enough money to live. His MRC stipend was not enough to support a child, but his uncle Arthur, who made success selling anti-acids in the drugstores he owned, gave money to Francis to stay on. Francis is basically, his family's shoe business had failed in the mid-1930s. So there was, and I didn't know how poor Francis was. He hocked his typewriter several times. So that was, you know, it was close. But, you know, the movie where Jeff Goldblum plays me, you know, has Francis and I racing for the Nobel Prize. We were just racing to beat Pauling. You know, it was quite different. And, you know, because Pauling had, you know, humiliated Cambridge, so we wanted to bring the honor back to Cambridge. The moment we saw the structure, we knew we'd get the Nobel Prize, but it was not the incentive. So, you know, there was no doubt when we saw it, boy, this is big. And, but it wasn't the primary motivation. I wanted to make a movie, a parody of Chariots of Fire, which I wanted to start in a church, and I was showing Francis where we were going to be buried. And so then it soon becomes clear we're in the Abbey, and I'm taking him to see where Darwin lay, which I, you know, still think is where we should be buried. You know, it makes symmetry. And but then, you know, we were really racing against God. You know, motivation was to understand life in terms of chemistry. That was really it. It was very strong. And Francis naively believed after we had the structure, less people would find God attractive, which was certainly not true. And so we have had no influence. I mean, the real person who changed things was Darwin. I don't think we changed anything. So, you know, the fundamentalists aren't after me. You know, their world was basically destroyed by Darwin. And anyways, this is, you know, my rules. Thinking back, you know, if you don't speak to your competitors, who do you speak to? You know, Wilkins was really the only other person interested in the DNA structure I could talk to. Bruce and Kendra had no interest in it whatsoever. So, you know, once they saw it, of course they knew, yeah, that was big. And I, you know, in conclusion, I'll say, I knew of Burnell and the Van Kooken paper when I was a graduate student in Indiana. You know, it was viruses, what, you know. So I had seen the X-ray photographs of TMV as a graduate student, and when I got to Cambridge, of course, Francis and I talked about the TMV photos. And then when Bragg told Francis and I we couldn't work on DNA, I had to do something else. And it was obvious that TMV had to be put together by protein subunits. And I had read a paper by, you know, I spent most of my time just reading in the library, by Frank, F.C. Frank at Bristol, who was speaking on crystal growth, and crystals grew by dislocations. And I thought a helix always gives you something to stick next to, the next helical structure. Cozy corners, the key. And so when I read that paper, I really was, you know, absolutely manic that TMV had to have a helical structure, and started taking, took the X-ray pictures. And then it was very relaxed. It was 54 when we published the paper. You know, today I was, you know, I think I took the photos in March. And, you know, then thought it was, you know, it was the 10th layer line. No. Well, anyways, the pictures weren't good enough to say exactly what it was. but Ken Holmes talked about yesterday. So I'm here only because of Brunel. If Brunel hadn't been in Cambridge and hadn't wanted to study proteins, Proust would have never been on hemoglobin, there would never have been an LMB unit, and Brunel changed, you know, I'm not listed as one of the five Nobel Prize winners, but boy, I wouldn't have had mine without Brunel. And I did go and see him once and told him about TMB, helical structure, as Ken said. You know, I just remember him saying, yeah, it's shaped like a pineapple. And but he showed no interest in it. You know, I think he was really interested by that stage in, you know, the big picture science and society and the details. You know, he enjoyed it a little, but it wasn't what drove him at that time. But certainly he was a very remarkable man, and certainly was a key, you know, he was the hero for Proust and Kendra. He was their hero. All right, that's my rules. Thank you.